Hey there, this is Brian Zond, and welcome to my sermon podcast. I'm glad that you're interested in the sermons that I preach here at Word of Life Church in St. Joseph, Missouri. And if you ever feel inclined to help us by supporting us financially, you can do that at our website, WOLC.com. Thank you. Fire in the Bones, the Life and Times of Jeremiah. That's what we're doing in November. That's what we're doing while we wait for Advent. We're looking at the life and times of Jeremiah. Jeremiah was the poet who prophesied during the final 40 years of the Jerusalem monarchy. Last Sunday, we saw how Jeremiah was a prophet for the end time, because there are always things that are ending, and he was prophesying in the end times. It was the end of the world. You say, well, it wasn't the end of the world. It was, if you were a Jew living in Jerusalem in the 6th century B.C., your world had come to an end. And Jeremiah prophesied during those last 40 years. He was a prophet for the end times, and we sort of got something of an overview of Jeremiah's life. This Sunday, I want to look at the book of Lamentations. Lamentations is the book that comes right after Jeremiah. It's stuck in between Jeremiah and Ezekiel. It's traditionally ascribed to Jeremiah, although we actually don't know who wrote it. But for our purposes, it fits in line with something that Jeremiah could have written. We're not told. We don't know who wrote it. But it's a poem that was written in response to that terrible catastrophe of 587 B.C. when after 500 years the city fell and people died and they were sent off into exile, and it was just a horrible tragedy. My sermon this morning is entitled, How Lonely Sits the City. And that's the opening line of this long poem. I read Lamentations every day this past week. It's 5 chapters long. It's a single poem. It's 5 chapters long. Chapters 1 and 2 and 4 and 5 each have 22 verses. The middle chapter, chapter 3, has 66 verses. It's one long poem. And I'm going to read just the first opening lines of it, but it sets the whole poem as basically like this. Lamentations chapter 1, verse 1. How lonely sits the city that once was full of people. How like a widow she has become, she that was great among the nations. She that was a princess among the provinces has become a slave. She weeps bitterly in the night, with tears on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she has no one to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemies. Judah has gone into exile with suffering and hard servitude. She lives now among the nations and finds no resting place. Her pursuers have all overtaken her in the midst of her distress. The roads to Zion mourn, for no one comes to the festivals. All her gates are desolate, her priests groan, her young girls grieve, and her lot is bitter. This is poetry. It's beautiful, broken-hearted poetry. It's in the art form known as lament. A lament is a song, a poem, a dirge meant to give expression to grief and sorrow. We don't know too much about lament in our culture. That's part of the problem. But lament has a large place in the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament. It's very prominent in the prophets. Much of the Psalms are Psalms of lament, and most especially this book known as Lamentations. The art of lament doesn't come from the powerful and the privileged. These kinds of songs are not composed in palaces. The art of lament comes from the weak, the oppressed, the broken, those that are looking at life from the bottom. I mean, there's a reason why the blues. Anybody like the blues? I like the blues. There's a reason why the blues comes from the southern plantation. But not from the plantation mansion. That's not where the blues are born. In the book of Revelation, the Roman Empire is depicted as a woman, Roma, who was patron goddess of Rome. And in the book of Revelation, John of Patmos depicts Rome as this rich, haughty woman who says, "I sit as a queen. I am no widow. I shall never see sorrow." See, when you're on top, when you're number one, when you're large and in charge, when you're Rome at the height of its glory, then you're like a queen that says, "I have no business singing the blues. I have no need for lament." Because Rome, like Babylon before her, believed that there would never be a need to sing the blues or to have a lament. Superpowers always have that particular hubris and arrogance. They believe the lie that they live above the possibility of suffering. They know there's suffering in the world, but it's for other people. And that's the lie that they tell themselves. Of course, the day comes when the queen does suffer. But it always comes as a shock. As Walter Brueggemann says, in our prosperity and security, we are schooled in denial. That is, to a large extent, our cultural situation for many of us. That we are just schooled in denial. We just simply deny the possibility of suffering that would cause us to need to lament. But if we're schooled in denial, then we don't know what to do when inevitable suffering comes. But the Hebrew people, they know. Formed in the crucible of suffering as they have been, they know what to do. You write a poem. You sing a song. You create a lament to give full expression to all the pain you feel. You do this for a reason. You make art out of your pain so that you can give it away to God. The laments are sung to God. God is the audience that the poet of lamentation is interested in. Others may hear it. Others may hear the lament, but it's really for God. And a lament isn't so much asking God to do something. It's just pouring out that which is on the end, the bile of sorrow and grief that's on the inside. It's got to go somewhere. And so it's given to God in the form of art, poem, song. Because ultimately God is the one alone who can bear it. And so instead of carrying it around, you release it in the lamentation. This is what the Jews are particularly good at. It. They're good at an artistic honesty with God. In their psalms and laments, the Jewish people know how to complain and grieve and rage and protest. And we Christians would be well served to be a bit more Jewish in our praying, which means a bit more honest. Will Willimon says, "The Psalms of Lament provide good Jewish ballast to our sometimes superficial and just a bit too cheerful Christian piety." Have you ever met these Christians who, no matter what, will not give voice to their pain? You ever met these people? They call it faith. But they just refuse. I mean, you know they're going through a terrible time of profound loss. They are in the midst of sorrow. And you ask them, out of compassion, "How are you doing?" "Blessed and highly favored of the Lord."
Blessed and highly favored. Yeah, but your house burned down and your dog died and your wife left. Blessed and highly favored of the Lord. That's not faith. That's denial. That's all that is. Jeremiah knows better than to play that game. He knows that healing will never come. There is this lump, this bile of grief and sorrow inside of you, and you have to let it out. So I read the opening lines of the poem that's called the Book of Lamentations. I would just give it the title of the first line of this beautiful brokenhearted poem, How Lonely Sits the City. That's what I would call this poem. I think that should be the name of it, How Lonely Sits the City, because it's an art form, it's poetry. So I read it, but that's not the best we can do. We could turn it to song, and of course, in our cultural context, that's what we have the blues for. So here it is again in a different form, How Lonely Sits the City.
How lonely sits the city that once was full of people. How like a widow has she become? She was a princess among the provinces, but now she is a slave. Smoky burned out ruin of a soul. So bitterly she weeps, with tears upon her cheeks. Of all her lovers to comfort, she has none. All her friends they have betrayed, the beauty now decayed, and desolation thus she has become. And how lonely sits the city where love has been rejected, where justice protecting the mightiest strong, where the poor and powerless get the blame for me. How lonely sits the city, hear her song. Departed, the daughter of Zion left discarded. How your foes now mock what you've become. And how lonely sits the city where love has been rejected, where injustice. Yeah.
No longer in her riches can she gloat. The stench of her lament fouls the air. Whence comes advent? How lonely sits the city of lost hope.
That's lamentation. That's lament. That's the blues. The capital city that was home to the Hebrew kings for five centuries has fallen. Its walls are broken down, gates are burned with fire. The palace is in ruins. Worst of all, the temple. The temple that's been there since the days of Solomon. The temple that was the house of God on earth. The temple has been plundered, pillaged, burned to the ground, and is no more. It's 9/11 times 10. It's the end of the world. Many have been carried away into captivity. Many have been killed. But there are some that are still there. In some ways, their lot is worst of all. They're scavenging for food. There's no food. They're trying to find food. There's starvation. Social order has all broken down. People just walk around not recognizing one another, blank stares in their face. It's the end of the world. So let's walk with the poet through the smoldering ruins of his beloved city and see how he turned his sorrow into a prayer of poetic lament. Is this the city that was called the perfection of beauty, the joy of all the earth? My eyes are spent with weeping. My stomach churns. My bile is poured out on the ground because of the destruction of my people. I mean, he is so traumatized that he, as he walks through the city, seeing the devastation, that he vomits out of grief, out of sorrow, out of horror. Look and see our disgrace. Our inheritance has been turned over to strangers, our homes to aliens. We have become orphans, fatherless. Our mothers are like widows. We must pay for the water we drink. The wood we get must be bought. Happier were those pierced by the sword than those pierced by hunger. My soul is bereft of peace. I have forgotten what happiness is. Wow. Have you ever been in a place that was so bad and you were there so long that you've had that thought go through your mind? I've forgotten what happiness is. I know I used to have it. I know there was a time when I knew what it was, but I really can't remember what it is. The armies of Nebuchadnezzar have destroyed Jerusalem, leaving death in their wake. And Jeremiah doesn't hold back from describing the catastrophe with brutal honesty. Most of the time, Jeremiah, or whoever the poet is, attributes the catastrophe to the punishment of God. Most of the time. Throughout this lamentation, this 154 verses of this single sad song, most of the time, Jeremiah attributes what has happened to the punishment of God. In other words, we deserve this. This thing has happened to us because we have sinned, and we've sinned grievously, and God has himself brought this horrible judgment upon us. And Jeremiah makes that move because it's better to be punished by God than to be abandoned by God. I mean, he's in this situation where either we're abandoned by God or we're punished by God. And I think he would rather say, I'm punished by God than abandoned by God. And yet, he's not entirely consistent about this. You see, as you read this poem, if you don't just read a little section of it, you know, over five, but you sit down and read the whole thing through. Maybe do it two or three times, because the first time you're just kind of getting used to the art form. One of the things that the poet does, I'll alert you to, is he's talking about the city, and then he'll shift, and he'll be the city. And the city is a woman. The city is feminine. The daughter of Zion is usually the moniker given. And you hear the woman herself begin to talk. Most of the time, the woman says, God has brought this on me for my sins. But sometimes she protests and says, no, I didn't deserve this. And God's going to have to help me. You see the poet kind of reeling back and forth. I mean, he's not trying to do theology. He's trying to deal with the pain in his soul. So, for example, in chapter 3, the poet says, we have transgressed and rebelled. And you have not forgiven. You have wrapped yourself with anger, killing us without pity. You have wrapped yourself with a cloud so that no prayer can pass through. You have made us scum and garbage. That's about as harsh as it gets. That actually the woman is speaking as the city, and she said, we've rebelled, we've sinned, and you've brought this on us, you've killed us. You can say the Babylonians, but God, it's you. You've killed us and we deserve it. We're scum, we're garbage, and I don't even know why I'm praying. You wrap yourself with a cloud and no prayer can get through. But just 10 verses later, in the same chapter, you see how the poet is storm-tossed. At one point, talking like this, but then it changes 10 verses later. I called on your name, O Lord, from the depths of the pit. You heard my cry for help. You came near when I called on you. You said, do not fear. You have taken up my cause, O Lord. You have redeemed my life. You have seen the wrong done to me. I want to back up a second. I skipped something I wanted you to see here. I said that the poet generally, almost always, attributes this catastrophe to God. And the argument is we deserve this. But here's an example where the poet pushes back. When all the prisoners of the land are crushed underfoot, when human rights are perverted in the presence of the Most High, does not the Lord see it? And this is where sometimes the poet's saying it's God that's done this, but there's a few times where he says, wait, this isn't a violation of human rights. This is a perversion of justice. And doesn't God see what has happened to us? Isn't God going to do something? And then it goes into this part here about where you've wrapped yourself in anger and you've killed us and you've wrapped yourself with a cloud that no prayer can get through. But then 10 verses later, the poet giving voice to the city of Jerusalem as the daughter of Zion, saying, yeah, no prayer can get through to God. But then, in the next moment, but God, you heard my cry. You did hear my cry. And God even answers back and says, do not fear. Which is what heaven always has to say to earth. So, we're scum, we're garbage, we deserve this. You wrap yourself with anger, you are killing us. You wrap yourself with a cloud, no prayer gets through. And oh God, you heard my prayer and you heard my cry and you spoke to me and said, do not fear. You see kind of just the craziness of it. If you're trying to do theology with the book of Lamentations, good luck. But that's not what it's for. It's for a lot of things, but one thing, it's to show you that the Bible knows what it's like to be in a crazy time. Where you don't even know, where you're bouncing back and forth. And so, prayer does get through, and God answers and says, do not fear. And then the woman says, God has taken up my cause, and I've been wronged, but God's going to take up my cause. So is God responsible for the catastrophe? The poet doesn't know. The poet isn't certain. Most of the time the poet says, yeah, I think we deserve this, but not all the time. Sometimes, no, we didn't deserve it. It bounces back and forth. Well, it doesn't really matter. Most of lamentation is bleak. It's a broken-hearted dirge devoid of all hope. When I say most, I mean 94%. 90. There are 10 verses out of the 154 that have hope. 144 have no hope. But these moments of hope, it's like everything. It's dreary. It's foreboding skies. But twice, just twice, momentarily, in the Lamentations, it's like there's a little crack in the clouds and a ray of hope shines through. It only happens twice. One of them I just read to you, where the poet says, oh, God did hear my cry, and he said, don't fear, and God's going to take up my cause. That's one. The other passage of hope in this otherwise hopeless, bleak book is, in fact, one of the most beautiful passages of hope in all of the Bible. I mean, really, it's the last place you would expect to find this. But here it is. Lamentations chapter 3, verse 21. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I will hope in Him. The Lord is good to those who wait for Him, to the soul that seeks Him. It is good that one should wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. Behind every beautiful thing, there's been some kind of pain. In the ruins of Jerusalem, the poet finds hope. Not in a particular outcome. No, no, no. I mean, it's all come to an end. Jeremiah doesn't have hope that something's going to turn out good. Certainly, Jeremiah would have no idea what that would be. If you ask Jeremiah, what is your hope for good to come out of this? He says, I can't fathom how that could ever happen. I can't imagine that. But what Jeremiah does do is he has hope in God. Not a particular outcome, not to get out of this. It's what's done is done. The people have died. The city is in ruins. His dreams and hopes are broken and shattered. He doesn't have any hope in a particular outcome, but he does have hope in God. The Lord is my portion, therefore I will hope in Him. The Lord is good to those who wait for Him, to the soul that seeks Him. And then you get this line. It is good that one should wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. I mean, he's brokenhearted. He's just... Have you ever seen that famous painting that Rembrandt did of Jeremiah in the grotto and the city's in flames? And he's just forlorn. And he's just sitting there. There's nothing to do. I mean, lamentation is not a prayer for God to do something. It's just getting the bile out so it doesn't destroy his soul entirely. He's just trying to get it out. But there's nothing to do. But does he have hope? Yes. Hope, not in an outcome. Not how something good can come. I don't know. But my hope is in the Lord. My hope is in God. And I'll just sit quietly and wait for the salvation of the Lord. Wait for the salvation. Hebrew word, teshuva. Teshuva. It's the root of the name Yahshua that you know as Jesus. In other words, When your life is in ruins, when everything has fallen apart, it's good to wait for Jesus. You don't know what Jesus will do. You don't know when Jesus will come, but what else can you do? I sit quietly and I wait for Jesus. You know, Jesus, he had some friends. Disciples, yes, but I think that possibly the closest thing that Jesus had to a best friend was Lazarus. Lazarus wasn't a disciple. But we're told that Jesus loved Lazarus in a special way. Lazarus has two sisters, Martha and Mary. Jesus loves them too. He's close to this family. This is a wealthy family. We know they're wealthy. They have a big estate. And it's in Bethany, a village on the Mount of Olives, 2 miles from Jerusalem. And when Jesus comes to Jerusalem, whenever Jesus comes to Jerusalem, that's where he stays. They have enough room to accommodate Jesus and his disciples. But I think more than that, this is a place where he could relax, where he could not have to be dealing with the prying eyes of the Pharisees all the time. It's good to have friends, you know. And Lazarus and Mary and Martha love Jesus. He's their friend. One day, Lazarus became sick. And Mary and Martha knew it was serious. At this time, Jesus was just across the Jordan, on the other side of the Jordan, where John had been baptizing earlier. You can get there in a day. It's there and back. You can get there in a day for sure. And so, Lazarus is sick. And they send a message to Jesus. The one whom you love is sick. They didn't even have to say his name. Just the one whom you love. Your best friend, Jesus, he's sick. So Mary and Martha sent a messenger to Jesus. Jesus is somewhere out there. And they said, Lazarus is sick. And they're waiting on Jesus. They're waiting on Jesus. Meanwhile, Lazarus is getting sicker and sicker. And they're waiting on Jesus, but Lazarus is getting sicker. They're waiting on Jesus. Jesus is a healer. Jesus will come. Jesus will heal. They're waiting on Jesus. Jesus doesn't come. They're waiting on Jesus. He's the healer. He's going to come and heal, but Jesus doesn't come. And they're waiting on Jesus, and Lazarus is getting sicker, and then Lazarus dies. And still Jesus doesn't come. Finally, more than a week after they had called Jesus, 4 days after Lazarus has been buried, finally Jesus comes. The Gospel of John tells it like this. When Jesus saw Mary weeping, and those who came with her also weeping, he was greatly disturbed in his spirit and deeply moved. He said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. Jesus wept. Jesus wept. Can you envision a weeping Jesus? Now, why is Jesus weeping? Jesus knows what he's about to do. He's already hinted at it in some conversations he's had right there at that moment with both Mary and Martha. He knows what he's going to do. He knows, and indeed, we know the story. Jesus says, "All right, take me to the where you've laid him," and they take him to this cave with a stone in front. And Jesus says, "Move away the stone." And they said, "Well, you know, by now there'll be a foul odor." He said, "If you believe, you'll see the glory of God. Move the stone." And they move it back, and he says, Lazarus, come forth. And he that had been dead came forth, bound hand and foot. And Jesus said, loose him and let him go. Jesus knew he was going to do all that, so why is he weeping? Jesus weeps because he's present to us in our pain and suffering. I mean, what he's going to do doesn't alter the fact that in this present moment there's pain and suffering. And Jesus is not aloof from that. He does not remain impassible to it. He joins us in it. He shares it with us. He comes into our pain in the present moment with us. No matter what he's going to do, he's going to be with us in the present pain. See, Jesus is also going to raise your loved ones from the dead too. But that doesn't mean Jesus isn't present with you in your present suffering. Just because Lazarus is going to be raised doesn't negate the fact that we feel pain right now. But Jesus doesn't say, hey, someday it's going to be all right. Jesus weeps. He shares our pain with us. Jesus suffers with us. I believe all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. I believe Julian of Norwich has seen something that is true. But while Lazarus is still in the tomb, Jesus weeps. Why? Because we're weeping. He weeps in solidarity. He weeps with Mary. He weeps with Martha. He weeps with all that are weeping at graves. He's present to us in our pain. Jesus shares our suffering. When Dietrich Bonhoeffer was in that Nazi prison waiting for his execution, he wrote these words, "Only the suffering God can help." Dietrich Bonhoeffer, in the midst of the Nazi nightmare of Germany, in prison, awaiting execution, said, "I don't need a God who is above it all. I need a God who can join me in my suffering." And through the incarnation, the impassibility of God is bypassed when Jesus becomes the man of sorrows. So while you're waiting for Jesus to raise Lazarus, whatever that may be in your life, Jesus weeps with you. We can bear almost anything if we can do it in the company of our friends. And Jesus is the friend that sticks closer than a brother. While you're waiting for Lazarus to be raised, Jesus weeps with you. May this bring comfort to your soul. Amen. Stand with me. And we're going to come to the table of the Lord, and we'll find comfort there as well. By his wounds we are healed. When we bring our wounds to the wounds of Christ, it does not multiply woundedness, but it promotes healing. So we come and we find bread and wine that is a participation in the body and blood of Jesus. But not just body and blood, it's broken body and shed blood. These are gifts that come from the suffering of Christ. And you bring your suffering to the suffering of Christ. And the mystery is that that's when the healing begins. So bring your wounds to the wounds of Christ.